All right, so another Yellow Point retreat. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back, everybody. I know there's three or four new people this year, which is always a cool thing to have new people here. Such a great place. I don't know if you've seen these around anywhere. Teresa had this great idea, and I really like it. Unless you are waiting for a call from the master, please leave your cell phones in your room as a courtesy during satsang, or turn them off. Thank you. That's great. And just a few things to clear up. The staff here is on a set timeline, so we have to be finished and ready for all the meals when they're ready. So we have to shut things down when they're ready to go, which you noticed is always right back here. And also there's a book sales. There was one this afternoon downstairs here. There'll be another one tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 and Sunday morning at 8:30 if you want to buy many of the different masters' books downstairs. So there was an idea brought forward to me because I like little stories. And this is a story about first contact. We all have our stories about first contact, meaning the first time we hear about the path. And this happened today. So it just happened. Larry, one of the local initiates, was walking down the path coming into the lodge here, and one of the outgoing ladies was leaving and stopped and asked him what was going on here now. And he said, well, it's a Crown of Life Meditation Society having this meditation weekend. And she got all excited. She said, oh, wow, well, I meditate a little bit, and this is interesting. I need to know more. And Larry said, well, come on in and come down to the bookstore down below. And she didn't want to come because she thought she was intruding. And Larry said, no, it's no problem. Come on down and check out the books and see what you think. So she came down and she was just blown away. She bought $28 worth of books. We talked about four or five people that were down there about the path and what it was all about. And she got really excited and she started talking about her mother who had died recently, and she has been talking to her in the astral plane, and she's been reading books about the astral plane, and this kind of just all fit in with this, and she was over the top. Anyway, so she was really excited. Larry was going to give her our email address, but he couldn't remember it, so he gave him his, and she wanted to come to Yellow Point next year. And she's going to contact Larry, he's going to contact me or Manik, and anyway, it might all happen. That was her first contact. Who knows where it's going to go from there, but that was pretty neat. My first contact was in 1974 with Kitty when I started working for Lifestream. That's another whole other story, but just recently Kitty was over for dinner, and she mentioned this book to me, which I Never Say Goodbye, which I had for years but never read. So I started reading it, and it's got some really interesting stories in here of this little group of people who traveled with Kirpal to out in India to different places for satsangs. There's about five or six of them. So I'm just going to read one of those stories right now, and it's going to continue on the whole weekend. We're going to continue the stories about this little group of people that are having fun with Master Kirpal. So they're driving through the countryside. And they're in their ambassador car. Remember those Indian, those old ambassadors? They're in the car. After Master left, we hit the road again and proceeded on the way to the Punjab. Driver, please close the window. It's blowing in too much. Last year we all got flu from this wind. Werter, one of the fellows, Werter, he's a German guy, pleaded. Our practical chauffeur, however, was adamant and refused, as he had to signal constantly with his hand through the open window. A real professional virtuoso. He dashed along the road without fear, firmly convinced of his own unsurpassed skills. To avoid crashing into oncoming vehicles, he would swerve the car sharply and abruptly to the left at the last possible moment. He's playing chicken, Bob lamented. Chauffeur, Miraji calmly addressed the young man. "Chauffeur, you are driving too fast. Lessen the speed immediately." "Don't make me nervous," the driver quickly replied, while fidgeting on his seat and honking vigorously as an enormous truck approached us head-on at full speed. Realizing that there were just a few seconds left before death would pick us all up, our daring young driver turned the steering wheel to the left with such speed that, like a weightless leaf, the car flew off the wet pavement up into the air, and as Miraji reached over and switched off the ignition, the white ambassador overturned and crashed on its left side down a slope, the wheels spinning with a screeching noise right over our heads. The chauffeur, this virtuoso, like a veritable monkey, dodged out of his open window while we lay on top of one another in a twisted heap inside the car. Dead silence reigned supreme in spite of the droning wheels above. In shock, one of Werder's eyes stared at me from below, while the other was covered with Bob's head, unnaturally turned to one side. Time passed and passed, and finally someone fearfully inquired, "Is everyone alive?" As no one was hurt, our voices once again sounded loudly inside the car. Cautiously untwisting ourselves, one by one, we left through the open window, Bob crawling out last. On our bodies, not even a scratch, just a small bruise here and there, including one from the doorknob on the top of my head. A concerned Indian crowd already surrounded the overturned vehicle, eager to help in every possible way, talking excitedly among themselves. One curious man was leaning his elbow on the front wheel that was suspended in midair. The other, in a bluish turban, propped his hand on the car's headlight while Miraji, slightly bending forward, walked right under his arm, and someone else held the door open straight up into the sky. A rugged farmer who left his plow back in the field along with others helped the chauffeur in his effort to turn the car over. The farmer, addressing everyone, talked adamantly. "I saw the accident from the beginning to the end, and had absolutely no doubt that not a single soul should leave the car alive. It is beyond my understanding that no one was even harmed." Werder, meanwhile, back in good spirits, enthusiastically took movies of the whole event. The blue plastic container of ashram water stood solemnly by the side of the road. Then Master's gray car slowly approached the scene and stopped in front of the overturned ambassador. Serenely and unhurriedly, the Satguru walked towards us. Attentively, he surveyed the whole situation, his face a picture of peace and tranquility. Waiting patiently until the car was finally back on its wheels, he then turned to our unhappy chauffeur and looked at him silently. "Surely," I thought, "Master will bawl him out, but good." The Satguru smiled warmly, then blessed the young man with a piece of parshad and told him very softly, "From now on, dear friend, please follow my car wherever you go." The frisky chauffeur gazed at the superior one with boundless gratitude as a faint smile slowly began to live in his ashen face. Quietly, Master glance turned to us, and again the world with its countries, people, flowers, skies, and accidents faded away into naught as his saintly love and deep compassion filled our souls to the brim. When, after a while, the Satguru left, the world came back. The road, the flowers on the slope, the people, the ambassador's car, but for a moment all seemed to be tinted with the oneness of love as the shift in values continued deepening and widening. We got back into the seats and of the car and waited for Miraji, who had followed the Satguru up the road. On her return, Miraji said Taiji had told her of an explanatory comment that Master had just made. "On Monday, September 10th, the Satguru said, "the cosmic conditions were such that some of them would have been killed, and that is why I postponed the trip for one day." "Verily," gasped Bob, stricken with amazement, "from the gallows to a pinprick, so much concession is given." Gyaniji was indeed right. Our adventurous driver maneuvered rapidly, following Master's car like a shadow, while placid pastures and fields swept quietly past on both sides of the road. "Miracle," Werder exclaimed suddenly and as ecstatically. "Absolute miracle. Nothing happened to us, not even a scratch. Nothing happened to the car. Not even a window was broken, and the dent on one side was insignificant. Not even a drop of ashram water was spilled from this blue plastic container. Unbelievable." and energetically wiping mud from a large apple that he picked up from a puddle of water next to the overturned car, Werner munched it with gusto. So Mira, turning to us, said, face radiant with joy, as you have now witnessed, Master can postpone death any time he so wishes. And that's what happened.
Good story.
And there's actually a picture. If you see this, I'll leave it open. There's a picture of the car turned upside on upside down, almost upside down, with people all around it. It's hard to see, but I'll leave it here. You can look at it later. Now I'll turn it over to Don.
Well, it's pretty obvious that actually without too much arrangement on my part, the theme that has developed for tonight is stories of the Master. And it is stories of both Sanchi and of Master Kripal. I'd like to read one excerpt from an early account of a disciple that was with Sanchi. This is from the first bound volume, number one, of Sant Bani magazine. And this is an excerpt from an account by Dennis Huntington, who was an initiate in California and went to see Sanchi. And this, when he came back, this was a part of his relating to the Sangat, some of his experience. This is, again, before we all had met Sanchi, before many he had come on tour, and it was this process of discovery and learning more and more about him and accepting and loving him more and more as we heard these stories. The night before I left, I was going for a walk, and he saw me standing where I was and beckoned me to come on with him. So I thought, I never get to go with him alone anywhere. This is going to be great. Of course, I did not speak his language, but we took a little walk outside the ashram, and he was just buoyantly healthy and radiant and beautiful and just exuding everything that was good. He was really going jolly. And this is one thing that inspired me so much. Since I was never able to be with my master, Master Kripal, to actually be with someone who is so loving, who is so extremely jolly. We all talk about being jolly, but it's really nice to actually see someone who is. I'll just regress momentarily to say that the miracle for me was perhaps to get an inkling of what it must be like to really love one's master. Because just being around him, he's so very simple, so very beautiful. His simplicity is beautiful, and everything is on the level, a simple level of goodness and love. And that's the miracle I needed. I guess many of us who, when we first met Sanchi, were overwhelmed with the simplicity of the village and of the people and the simplicity with which he approached us. And this is a very common experience. And that's the miracle that I needed. I guess you get what you need. And on that level, I read all the books and learned all the lessons intellectually fairly well, made lots of mistakes, but I hadn't manifested the positive things the way we all should. So for me, it was a great experience. It was an opportunity on the level of man to have some inkling of what it's like, at least on that level, to be with someone who's so pure and so good. And you can't help but love him just by being there. He's truly humble. and there's love all around him. Things have happened around the village and surrounding villages. People have changed. So as we took that walk, he would talk to me. He would say a couple of words like, thank you, because I was always saying thank you. People started laughing at me, but they're serving you all the time in that village. So he was going to teach me a few words in Punjabi, and it was really a happy thing. I couldn't say a complete sentence. I couldn't even remember the word once he told it to me. But I was happy to have the experience of just doing that on the very simple level of non-intellectual understanding. Perhaps I gained more by not speaking the language because I was really receptive to all the direct vibes that were abounding every moment in his presence. And I was feeling very good to see him so robust. As we walked down that road, he was like Superman. We were really setting a good pace. So he's very happy to be in the village where everybody loves him. He is really loved. This is the one. It was so great for me to be there and not to be confused with a lot of intellectual questions or doubts. They have a direct experience of love and they love him totally and purely. I'm sure the people who asked him antagonistic questions in New Delhi were just trying to settle the confusion in their minds and to see who is a master and who isn't. But they didn't come to him with love. And as a man of love, he doesn't want to be where love isn't drawing him. He isn't out to prove anything. As he said to me, I am like a fakir man. I don't want an army of followers. If there's a true seeker who could benefit from any help and guidance that I could give as seva in Master's cause, I'd be most happy to help. He asked me to relate to the people here that through Master's will, you know, it's all Master's will, that he expects that he will come here in 1977. And as you heard in the message and as you read in any of the literature, that has come from Sanchi. And as you've learned from any of the literature that has come from Sanchi, meditation is the key. If we do meditation, we will grow in love. And he doesn't want to come here to prove anything. He wants to come here because there's love here. And where there's love, he can help us in some practical matters. Those of us who have already been initiated and those who are seeking initiation will benefit fantastically if they have a receptive and loving attitude when he comes. And he did come in 1977. Prior to that, in March of that year, I went over to see him with the encouragement of my loving wife, Charlotte, and was encouraged to invite him to come to California. And it was a matter of just 3 or 4 months later in July when he did come. And that was his first trip to Shama's retreat. During that first visit, when I was with him, this is just a brief story, and then we're going to have other people tell stories. He would personally get up and ring the bell. There was only 20 or 22 people in the group. And at 3 a.m., he would ring the bell every morning. I remember being very diligent in getting up. And it was about the second or third or fourth day. I remember hearing the bell, lying in bed, and thinking, oh, yeah, there's the bell. Okay, I better get up. And than dozing off to sleep, right? Not exerting very much willpower or taking action. And I don't know, it wasn't a, like a long time, but a certain amount of time passed. And I think it was later on that day that I had my interview, and in the middle of the interview, he leaned forward and said to me, "Who do you love more, master or sleep?" And for me, when I came home and I told that story, it was always a story about that particular moment in time when I had not gotten up. But over the years, that story has taken a much deeper significance. And the master will refer to our attachment to our physical surroundings, to all the different aspects of the illusion. When I was with Sanchi another time, he said, "Everything you see is part of the prison." And it's like, you know, every so often there's like one sentence and it just reframes everything. And so this was like that. He had said to me, "Who do you love more, master or sleep?" And it's really a lifelong question. The path is a lifelong process of learning not to love the sleep that the soul is currently attached to, immersed in, and learning to redirect our attention to the master, to love him more than sleep, than the distractions on the physical plane, and the process of coming in contact with him through the meditation. And so now it is time for Eric Perkins to tell a story. And then we have a couple other people, and then we have a short little movie.
Thank you all. It's my pleasure to be here. The last time I was at Yellow Point was in 1977. I had the good fortune to be here when Sanchi was here. So it's nice to get back here 38 years later. I also had the good fortune to grow up at an ashram and to spend a lot of time with the masters when I was young. And I just wanted to share a little story from my first trip to India in May of 1976, when I went with my parents. I was 14 years old, and there were a few other people. It was a group of seven people in total, with two babies making up part of the seven. So there was five adults and two babies. And at that time, it was the biggest group yet to go see Sanchi. And only two or three other groups of three had gone before us. So it was a lovely time, and I remember attending the evening satsangs there at 77 RB, where Sanchi would give satsangs to the Indian Sangat, but when there were Westerners there, he would invite us to come as well. So the few of us Westerners, he would ask us to sit right in the front row, and then all the Indians would be behind us. And it was basically the whole village of 77 RB would come to those evening satsangs. It might have been 100 people. It was a good-sized group, it seemed. And he would have Bant and Parmeshri sing bhajans before the satsang would start. They were very young at the time, about my age, maybe a little bit older, I'm not sure. At that time, there were, you know, very few Westerners had been to see Sanchi, and there was no tradition of Westerners singing bhajans. So during the bhajans, part of the evening satsangs, at one point, the girls were singing Apana Koi Nahi, and that was a bhajan that Kent had brought a cassette back from India when he had gone in March. And when I rode around with him in the car, I had heard him playing a few bhajans, and I'd kind of learned the chorus to Apana Koi. So when they sang that bhajan, the rest of the Westerners there were just sitting there quietly, and I was actually singing the chorus back when the Sangat was repeating the line. And Sanchi noticed that, and at the end of the bhajan, he looked at me and he said, "Tomorrow night, you will lead the bhajan." And and all I knew was the chorus to that one bhajan, so I said, okay. And the next day, I attempted to learn a little bit more of that one bhajan that I knew the chorus to, and I asked someone, I think Papu may have given me a cassette. You know, there was no written version of the bhajans, no words to look at. So I just tried to listen to the tape enough to try and learn it, and I had a hard time. I was 14. I wasn't used to this process of learning the bhajans. And I managed to learn the first verse to Apana Koi. So I went to the satsang that night, and sure enough, Sanchi asked me to lead the bhajan, and I sang the chorus, and everybody repeated it. So far, so good. And then I sang the first verse, everybody repeated it, and then I stopped. And everybody looked at me, and I said, I'm sorry, that's all I know. And Sanchi just laughed and laughed, and he said, Bhotacha. And then he turned to Bhante Parameshri, and he said, you know, you finish the bhajan. So they picked it up and sang the rest. It was, you know, really a fun experience, and it was an early lesson for me in that the master loves us no matter how imperfect we might be or how incomplete we might be in doing what could be perceived as fairly simple things. So he was very gracious and very loving, and it made a big impression on me. Later on, he actually, when we were in interviews, he asked me, when I went back to Sampani to lead the bhajans at Sampani with Kent. So I had some work to do when I got back. But anyway, that was a fun experience. There's one other little story I was going to tell, very brief. When I saw Joe Gelbard today with his wife and daughter here, it reminded me of this. When I was younger than that at Sampani, around about 1971 or so, I enjoyed going to satsangs and hearing Master Kripal's voice on the tapes. It was a very soothing experience for me. I always loved it as a child. I didn't always understand exactly what he said, but I always enjoyed listening to his voice. There's a few talks that Master Kripal gave in which he used the phrase, children are the budding hopes of the coming generation. And when I heard that in satsang on the tape, I thought he was saying, children are the putty holes, as you know, and of the coming generation. And of course, I was a child, and so I was trying to reason through exactly what this meant. And I remember, you know, the first time I heard it, I thought, well, it's not the most glamorous role that children appear to have, but it, you know, there must be something to it. And the third time I heard it, I remember I was walking out of the hall with Joe Gelbard, you know, was walking out with me. As I say, I was about 11 years old, something like that. And I asked Joe, I said, Joe, what do you think Master means by that phrase, children are the putty holes of the coming generation? And Joe looked at me and he just started laughing. And he just couldn't contain himself. And finally he said, oh, yes, no, that was children are the budding hopes. And I said, oh, that's what he was saying. That makes more sense. So when I saw Joe today, it just reminded me of that. It was so nice growing up as a child and having elder brothers around that could help me out with matters like that. It is a very supportive community, and in addition, of course, to my own parents. So that was my memory of Kripal Singh's talks from my childhood. And that's it for now. Yeah.
Somewhere, Rajinder. Okay. In India, whenever there's a rowdy kid, whenever there's a rowdy kid in the class, they make him the monitor so that when the teacher goes out, she says, look after the class, that he's the most naughty kid. And that's how I feel like today. when Teresa asked me to tell the story, I was just going out and I saw that sign, unless you're expecting a call from the master, leave your cell phone in your room. And the word master caught my eye and I looked at it. And we are all expecting a call from the master, and that's why we are here. Let's keep our battery charged, because signal is very strong here. I remember once Sanji came to Sanbani, and I did have a good fortune of talking to him on phone. That was only once. I remember it was very sweet. It was a little awkward for me because I did not know what to talk. How are you? You know, and his voice was so musical. How are you? Ki haal hai? Just like how he says. So, memory is fading. I was not a good story person ever. But I remember those times, and it was, at that time, we did not know the value, what we had gotten, who he was, and it was his grace. He came into our life, and just like how he says that the mother loves the children first, and the children reciprocate, that's how he loved us. And all the while when he said in the satsang, we don't come to satsang, he is the one who pulls us there. Same thing about this retreat, which is, he has pulled us here. It is not in our control. So I was very young, younger than Eric. So when Sanji came to our home, I was the youngest one and most ignorant one. I had no idea who Sanji was, and when he came, it was like love at first sight. Right from the first minute, all of us, we did not feel anything new, new meaning anything that he was from somewhere. It was like he was our relative, we always lived with him. He was so warm and so loving and 100% non-judgmental, just only love. One day I remember our TV broke down. First it broke down that the sound was gone. It was only picture. And then eventually the picture also broke down. And then so I came home from school and there was nothing to do. And I said, where is everybody? And then Papaji and Chaiji was sitting with Sanji. And I went there and I sat with him. And that was 1976 when Sanji had come. He stayed at our home for about almost a month. And then every day was like this, that in the afternoon he would tell stories of Master Kripal to Papaji and Chaiji, my father and my mother. And I don't even remember all those stories he told, but it was so sweet to sit and listen to those stories. And when the TV incident happened and he praised me, he said, look at this kid. He wants to hear the story of Master Kripal rather than watch TV or play. And I said, Sanji, the TV is broken. And I remember once Papaji offered to Sanji, Sanji, you want to come and see a movie? It's a movie called Paramatma. And Sanji said, no, I don't want to go see a movie. He said, the same siapa everywhere, like the same crying and all that in the movies. Now, I don't have the brain or that sharp memory to remember the stories, but now, one thing is that listening to satsangs, we can relive those stories. So more we hear Sanji's and Master Kripal's satsangs, it is like they are talking to us. And that is the best way for people who don't meditate to at least get to spend time with their master. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Is Ingrid here?
She just arrived.
I swear I'm going to be late for my own funeral. So I sit right here?
Right.
Well, thank you all for waiting. Oh, how long do we have?
10-ish minutes.
Okay.
Tell your two best.
Tell my two best? You're on. Okay. One of my favorite stories about Sanji. I was so privileged in 1977 to drive him a few times. And the second time that I had to drive him, I was at the top of Stephen, what was his name? Aaron Stevens. Here, thank you very much. At the top of his driveway, and my husband and I had these two Chrysler 300s. And I don't know if any of you know what those cars are, but they were huge. And so they're like six people could sit in each car. And there were like, there's enough room in the trunk for like six dead people, right? Because the trunks were humongous. So we were assigned to take the entourage that went with Sanchi, all their luggage, as many people as we could squeeze into the car to drive them. So I'm up the top of the driveway as we're at Master's time. After the Longar was over and he had to go back to Seattle from Vancouver, from Surrey. And Russell Perkins says, "Where's Ingrid?" And I'm yelling at him, "I'm up here cleaning out the car." He says, "Master wants you to drive him." And I'm like, "Wait a minute, this is all the way to Seattle." I said, "Oh no, Russell." I said, "My husband's going to have to drive him." Well, little did I know that I was an ingenue on the path, right? I did not know all the protocol and the rules that go along with that. Russell does this, like, little spin, and he says, "Ingrid G, when the master says you have to do something, you have to do it. Your husband is not going to be driving." I'm like, oh, my God. And then my whole body went to jelly. I started to shake like crazy. I was terrified to the core of my being. Oh, my gosh, I'm going to be for over 2 hours in the car with Sanchi. You know, a five-minute drive is one thing, but 2 hours, that is just like over the top. And I'm like, how did I get picked for this job? I found out many years later, which I can't share with you. But anyway, so here we are. I'm in the car driving this humongous car. My husband's had straight across seats in the front end, so there were more people. Actually, seven could fit in that car. But Sanchi got a bucket seat, I got a bucket seat. And in the back, I had the princes of the satsang, right? So we had Russell. I'm sure he didn't consider himself a prince, but I thought he was. And we had Papu. And we had Kulwant. And we had the singer, Pataji. So I had all these amazing people in my car, and I'm literally like drenched in sweat with just panic. Like, how did this happen? And I'm responsible. And I was just scared. So we had just finished the Longar. Everybody loaded in the car. And I was full. I always overeat. Especially at the Longars, food, Indian food is too good to waste, right? So we're driving, and so the first mistake I made, this was like a lesson in errors. The whole thing was one error after another. So the first error was to be afraid and be nervous. The second error, we go to the immigration, and everybody has to file out. And so Master and everybody had to, you know, show all their stuff on the inside. They had to get out of the car. And so Master was sitting on a bench. I'm sitting on the floor at his feet because I was like, okay, he's the guru. That's what I got to do. And then he looks at me and he taps and asks me to sit next to him. And I'm going, oh my God, no, I can't sit next to you. No, I can't do that. No, it was like everything in my body was going, no, I can't do that. And he looked at me, and gave me this very serious look. And I don't even remember. I think it was Aaron that tapped me on the shoulder, and he goes, "Master doesn't want you to make a scene. This is immigration." And I'm like, oh, okay. So I got up and backed myself up against the wall going, okay, this is immigration. And so we got through that, and we got back in the car. And so it's probably maybe an hour at the most since we'd really like eaten. And we're driving, and all these, I don't know how many of you were on the road on I-5 after the Peace Arch driving to Seattle. I don't know how many crazy of you were here. Were you one of them? There were cars that were honking. The windows were rolled down. People were waving at our car. First, it was funny. Everybody was laughing. And then Master got really sober. And he said something to Russell about, this has got to stop because this could create a problem. So I'm like, okay, so he's got this under control now. So it's going to get more normal now. Well, then he had this darling little basket of goodies. And he hands me a Burfi. And I'm sure all of you know how sweet Burfis are and how much you don't want one after you have overeaten at the Lungar. And so Master hands me one. And I said, oh, gosh, no, thank you. I am full. The car goes dead silent. And I get this tap. Russell was right behind me, and he taps me on the shoulder. And I said, what did I do? And he said, Ingrid G., whenever the Master gives you anything, you have to take it because you don't know what it's imbued with. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. I was really full, but I'm happy to eat it. Master is sitting there with this Cheshire Cat, you know, grin on his face, and I'm mortified, and he just laughs, and he puts the Burfi back in the bag. So I'm like, oh, okay, I don't have to eat it. Thank you, God. So we drive maybe 10 more minutes, and Master then hands me a Burfi. The car goes into an uproar, right? Because I'd already said no, and he'd already put it away, and here he was giving me another one. So I ate it, and I said thank you, and I was doing my Simran. And then he hands me another one as soon as I was done eating that one. And I looked, and I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I'm so full. So, but okay, it's imbued with something, and I don't know what it is. Okay, so I ate the other one. Then comes the next one. And I finished that one, and literally no sooner than I get the last swallow down, he hands me another one. This went on, guys, 6 Burfis in a row. And I thought, well, I'm being imbued with a whole lot of something. I was not sure what it was, but it was pretty wild. And, of course, over the years, I figured it out. But, you know, at that moment in time, it was like I could not believe what I was experiencing. And every time I got a Burfi, right, the whole car goes into just roaring laughter because I was full. I didn't want one. So anyway, over the years, just to the end of the story is that, of course, it was imbued with a lot of love, of support. Those people who know me know I've had a very, like probably many of you, roller coaster life with a lot of anguish, suffering, and back up against the wall, screaming for Master to help me out of whatever it is that was going on. And as the years went by, I realized that those Burfis were imbued with perseverance and love and wisdom and a willingness to turn my heart, my head, my life toward the Master. Most people aren't allowed to do healing work for a living, and not like the kind that I'm doing. And I have no idea how it happened, but I ended up, just things started opening up. You know, started to see things, hear things, know things. And I was able to help a lot of people with that wonderful gift. And I know that that was part of the Burfis. And then one day in 2002, the day before, I did not have the gift of reading the Akashic Records or doing Tibetan body and soul readings. The next day, I woke up with these gifts. And I'm like, oh my God, what is all this? Had no idea. I went into meditation. It was, this is your last Burfi. And that was the gift. So all this incredible love and support. So I'm very grateful that Master gave me those Burfis. Humiliated by all the mistakes that I made as an ingenue. I just want to say thank you to two people in this room who, over the years, because of all the strife that I've gone through, oh, I'm going to cry. But I just want to thank Helen Perkins for loving me so much, supporting me through just hell and high water, and for Russell to be her backup when she was like, didn't know what the heck was going on in my life, and I had to call Russell for help. So a lot of wisdom, a lot of love, and a lot of support. And just the satsang as a whole, just when you're in Master's arms, he gives you the strength to move through whatever you got to move through. Then do I have time for one more quick story? Nope, I'm done. Okay, I'm done. So thank you very much.
I'll see you tomorrow if we have time.
Oh, I'd love to. That'd be great.
We'll see.
All right, thank you.
We're going to now play a brief movie, and this is an excerpt from what I did when I went home last year was I got the audio file from Joe Gilbard's talk from last year, which also is a story of his first visit with Master Kripal. And those of you who were here will remember that that was an incredibly wonderful and just very engaging story. It ran about a half hour long. I took the audio file, put a bunch of images to it, and then decided that it was too long, and so I kind of cut off the beginning and I cut off the end, and what you're going to see is the middle of the talk, and it's pretty special. So let's just leave it like that. And we have to turn off the lights. Oh, that's the title I gave it.
Behind the picture. You said it's behind the picture?
Yay.
This trip that we made was a four-month ticket that we had gotten. 4 months. I'm not sure how that was decided, but somehow Mr. Connor, whatever, he arranged it, and it was 4 months. So we were at Samhan Ashram for a few days, and then we went up to Manav Kendra, and we were at his house at Dehradun. And within about a week, my mind started going absolutely crazy. And I was just a hippie off the streets. I mean, I was just a guy off the streets that hadn't done any meditation, hadn't done anything. And here we were, where the master would give us darshan in the morning. He would take off for the day at Manav Kendra and say, sit as much as you can. Put in as many hours as you can. And my mind totally, I couldn't live with what was going on in my head when I closed my eyes. Some of us might have had that experience, I don't know. Just horrors, lust, anger, greed, attachment, just stuff. It just wouldn't stop. And so after about a week, one morning, after morning darshan, I asked Master if I could speak to him. And he said, surely. And he called me over. And no translator, just sitting at the Master's feet. And he was the kindest father. That was my, I looked at him and it was like, this is my loving father. This is my loving father. And I said to him, I said, Master, I think I should leave. And he looked at me, why? He said, my mind, I can't control it. I can't. It's too difficult. And he just talked to me very lovingly. very sweetly. And told me to, you know, sit today, try today, see what happens, let me know later on. So that evening, Darshan, after he came back to Manavkendra, we were sitting there in front of him for Darshan. And this is what happened. I'm sitting there, and then he comes in, sits down, and he says, "My friend, you followed what I told you this morning?" And there I am, shrinking. And this is from The Light of Kripal. He said, "I think now you are wide awake." "Yes, Master." "That's all right. Thank God. There is no question of disappointment. Do as you're told and you'll succeed wonderfully. And do one thing at a time."
There's no question of disappointment. Do as you're told and you'll succeed. Wonderful. And do one thing at a time. I don't mean you may leave the world and go to jungle too. Deserted places to pass your day. Remain in the world, you see. Swimming can be learned in water only, not on dry land, do you see? That means the world well physically, intellectually, and also spiritually. Mm-hmm. They're all around, that's all. And do one thing at a time. You started from today, I think. You took my words to your heart. Is it? Or not?
I tried to.
There's no question. Try means not doing. Say yes or no. You do it. I'll do it. I must do it. See? Try means polite way of saying no. I won't do. When you want to do it, you do it. When you have decided, you have come to the right conclusion that we shall dwell all around physically, intellectually and spiritually. You have double time to do things, one third time is 8 hours. All right, 1/6, 1/8 time. 3 hours.
What do you do with the mind and control the
morning or evening or daytime? Just any way you like.
What do you do when the mind is in control?
Hmm?
When your mind is in control.
For mind control, you have been given some way, definitely. For concentration, there is no high road. The only way is concentrate, concentrate, and concentrate. In due course you come. I tell you, when I joined government service, I was not accustomed to sit in chairs. So very fast I could not sit on chair continuously for an hour. I tell you. When I was agitated that way, and this is so unfair of you to sit 12 hours, they would. And one day it was about 36 hours, continuously, without a plan. So this should have it. Your mind wants something, that's all right. Put in 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, and clarify what you want. You want, then put in time, out of 24 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours. That you quite follow, you should develop also spiritually. Does it repeat to you? Good. After all, you have to leave your body. Nobody else has to leave your body in your place. You should now learn to rise above the nothing of death. Oh, death, where is thy sting? One can say it. lost enemy that we have conquered. We have to conquer is death. How to conquer? No escape. Then learn to die. And this is the way to give you some demarcation, the very first step. Otherwise, my regular practice you can do. Does it appeal to your sense, what I'm telling you? Then do it, see. When you go away, oh, I went to the master, nothing was done. I wish you progress, you see, because if you do it, you sure to progress. Did you sit for meditation during the day, after that?
Just for maybe
15
or 20 minutes, because we're outside and
a lot of folks. Right. No, here's nobody. There's, of course, people running here, there. Except for the people. If there's any difficulty, that can be said. We say a little prayer to make an atmosphere. Some little prayer to me.
I've been up and down with my mind so many times, and each time, you know.
Mind is yours, and you belong to mind. Mind gets things from you. If anybody's servant is there, he catches you by the ears and drags you or by the leg, then do you approve? Appreciate? So mind is your servant. Like fire is a good servant, but a bad master. See? I won't let you go unless you progress. I take it. You are telling me I'm going this morning. Why? My mind is. Yes, I feel this RS, then you are going to know. So I'll get government task not to let you go from here. That's not what to do. Well, you're a safe man. I'm talking to you as a man to man, as a friend, as a sympathizer. You cannot do, you just obey. Literally what I say, you'll say that you're progressing. That's why I want to have a regular course. You see? You should eat what they are given at times, regular times, nobody to meet them, no correspondence, nothing of the sort. I think in a month or two, 3 months, they're in message of it. It's not given to us, only setting. Would you like I should not let you go?
Yes.
Then sorry. If you come up spending out so much money, only for that reason. You come here not for an excursion, I say. Then, thank you, bless you.
Yeah, I'd like that very much. When you let me.
I wish you'd like. If you'd like it, who stands in the way? Who is there? Your servant?
Yeah.
Your servant, mine? That's all I can say. Just be there, I'm fearing to hold it, so God will be there for you. Very definite way, as you want to make food. Since you question, in the beginning, natural man had to accustom himself by remembering. What you do today, tomorrow day, 10 days, 15, 20 days, natural man will go there. Regularity pays, my dear. Only if only one thing at a time.
So regularity like that pays. Wholly and solely, do one thing at a time. Now you say it is like that. Later you'll say, oh, it's all right. So the one last thing I want to say is that I always had regrets, or I felt bad for how difficult the time I had at Master's feet. I always felt bad about myself, that I'd wasted my time. And my first interview with Sanchi at Sanpani Ashram, I sat in front of him, and my question to him was, Master, I spent 4 months with Master Kripal in India, and I feel that I wasted a lot of time, and I didn't take advantage of the Master. And he looked at me and he said, "Don't you even dream that any moment you spent in the presence of Master Kripal wasn't for the highest benefit of your soul. Don't you even dream that any moment you spent with Master Kripal wasn't for the highest benefit of your soul."
Well, it's 9 o'clock, and that is a pretty good time to retire, and that is our program for tonight. And thank you, Joe, for sharing that wonderful story. It was so inspiring. And thank you, Charlotte, for finding that CD of Master Kripal that was the actual audio of the talk that Joe was referring to. Those are the two magic ingredients in that.